plenary session in the morning. So there'll be a number of us there. So I thought maybe we could all just sit down and talk about things prior to our CFAS face-to-face meeting. The CFAS face-to-face meeting is going to be March 19th and 20th. We'll start at 8 o'clock. We'll end at 6 o'clock on the 19th. And then we'll begin at 8, and we will adjourn at 3 p.m. So please don't book flights before 5 o'clock. We don't want people leaving early. It always corrupts everything. And I will meet with the Science Advisory Board and NIAAA staff on the evening of the 19th to review our progress, et cetera. If you have any ideas for inviting people to come and present to us, we've had these in the past. They've been quite useful in some cases. So if you have any ideas for inviting outside speakers who would have some overlap with CFAS, please send me those ideas so I can get some people there. A lot of these people book up really early and it's getting late. But if you have any of those suggestions, please let me know. If there are any specific items that you want on the agenda, we're preparing that this week and early next week. Please try to get those to me if possible. I would say that a reasonable amount of time will be spent on where CFAS is going as we think about the next iteration in the event that NIAAA decides to maintain CFAS, and I'm speaking to the Czar right now, so we have to start preparing for that. It takes a while to put this thing together, and the Jill, do you need anything about the sleeping rooms, or do you have that all taken care of?
That's the list that I have. It's up on the screen and also in the email. If there are any corrections needed, please let me know, and we should have actual reservation numbers within the next couple of weeks. But we're all set at the Hilton Rockville.
All right, so if your name is not up there, I guess that means you did not reserve a sleeping room. So take care of that with Jill as soon as possible. All right, the other thing is that the end of this month, our CFAS progress reports are due. This is the large one that we put together prior to each of our annual meetings to let each other and NIAAA staff know how much work we've been putting into CFAS. And Jill has the template that we're using this year. And I believe she sent that out to you. And it's a similar format to what we've used or what will be used for the progress report that's due April 1st to NIAAA. In terms of the developmental project, we received 37 of those. The Science Advisory Board and NIAAA staff commented on them, sent their rankings to me. I went through them, and we are going to be able to fund anywhere between 2 and 4 of these, depending upon the size of the budgets. And we've asked each of the ones that were accepted to do the 5-page proposal, and those are due on Sunday. And Jill, can you give me the screen?
I did.
And then you just
have to hit share desktop from the quick start.
From the quick start, quick start.
In the middle, you see something called share file. Do the pull down menu and hit share my.
Right.
There you go.
Can you see it?
Yes.
Yes, I see your emails.
All right, wait. Now what do you see?
The list of developmental projects.
All right, these are the list of developmental projects. List of developmental projects, and Jennifer has contacted reviewers. We have outside reviewers looking at these five-page proposals, and she will send them out early next week after we get them. The deadline is Sunday. And however, I would probably, and this is open to your comments, is to have each of these looked at by someone from CFAS, who would probably have a really good idea of how well these projects relate to our overall goals. So if there is something that you see on there, and I can send this list out to everybody, that you think you would be interested in reviewing for us, I will send you the five-page proposal when it comes in. And I would really appreciate everybody's help on that.
Hey, Ed, if our name is on it, can we review it, or should we abstain from?
I don't think I'd review my own application.
Oh, I mean, it's someone else's, but my name is on it. But point.
No, I don't think I would review any project that I was involved in.
Okay.
All right, I would review other projects. I don't think you should be. We don't have to exclude you from that, and we will consider your review and your any potential conflicts when it comes in. But I'd like to get an idea of how people from CFAS feel that these projects relate to our overall goals and the interrelatedness of the projects. Does that make sense? Does it make sense or no?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
So Ed, it's Ken. So
yeah.
So you're going to fund 2 to 4 of these. Is that right?
Right. Right.
Okay.
And depending upon how big the budgets come in and what the F&A on the individual projects are, because when we budget these things, we budget an average F&A, and some of the institutions have higher F&A, some have lower. So we don't know exactly how much money we have until we start allocating projects. hopefully we have a number to choose from, and some of them look like they fit in better than others, but we wanted to see the quality of the science and the investigators in more detail than we get from those one-page type of abstracts. And so that's where we are in the developmental projects.
Hey, Ed, it's Sarah. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did these projects, or maybe the answer is both yes and no, but are they independent projects, or are they requesting use of CFAS resources?
Some are requesting use of CFAS resources. Others are not, they're independent projects, but they link in with other work. All right, so the EEG brain connectivity links in, for example, with some of the functional imaging studies going on. The genetic biomarkers of FASD fits in with other biomarker studies that we have going on. So while they're independent, they have a firm foundation in the goals of CFAS. All right,
So if there was a project that, you know, maybe was requesting use of CFAS resources, but it wasn't obvious, would you ask that person to be one of the reviewers of the application?
In some
you would have identified that already.
In some cases, we've identified that already, and they should have been in touch. Because if the resource they need is not available, we don't need to consider the project.
Okay.
And there were projects that were – there was one or two projects, I think, that were eliminated for that reason. All right. people think we have all types of data that we can just throw out to them, and we don't. So, Tina, you just want to spend a few seconds on your conference call, which I'm sorry I had to miss?
Hi, Dr. Riley, it's Jill. I asked Tina about this. She's not on the call today, and she said she'd love to present something on it at the March meeting.
Okay, great. All right. I dealt with the Vancouver meeting and a lunch after our plenary. Dr. Jones, are you ready to go?
Well, I'm ready. I'm not sure the WebEx is ready, but I have here with me Deanna Veach, who has worked on this to try to get it working. So I think I'm ready.
All right. Well, before you go, while you try to get that up, are there any questions so far?
Just an announcement, Ed. It's Michael. I just wanted to let others know that the CFAS Symposium on Massive Data Reduction was accepted for the RSA meeting and will take place on first Sunday, 10 a.m.
I have that down. I was waiting for you to get on the call. Congratulations on that. And have any other CFAS members heard about symposium that they're in or anything? Okay, well, once again, we will be represented, well represented, and at that at the RSA. And last year's symposium was, I think, an overwhelming success, considering when it was. So, congratulations, Michael, and thanks for putting all that together again.
Yeah.
And I hope you have not suffered too severely in the weather that you've been having.
The weather here is bad. We're expecting more snow tomorrow and another major storm on Sunday. There's nowhere to put it anymore, but they're still able to. We're having our victory parade for the Patriots today, and Boston will be completely immobilized.
And congratulations on New England winning. It was quite a game.
Thank you. It was very hard work watching.
All righty. I will report my watching of the game to you at some future time. It was rather incredible, the environment I was in. So, all righty. Dr. Jones.
Right. So I'm going to present the dysmorphology core status report as of February of 2015, and we've sort of tried to model it after what we were, what we have to get in by December 1st, and so here we go. So these are the aims of the study. It's to assure consistency as well as accuracy and recognition of FASD at all CIFASD project sites throughout the world. That's number one. Second is to develop a training DVD that could be used to teach physicians and other healthcare professionals with little or no experience and diagnosis of FASD to correctly identify the characteristic structural features of FAS through a physical examination and to successfully diagnose or rule out this disorder. And finally, to develop a methodology where long-distance consultation can be provided to physicians and other healthcare providers in outlying areas throughout the world, so telemedicine. So to start off with aim number one, overall, the dysmorphology core has performed 3,780 standardized physical examinations on 2,615 unique subjects at consortium sites throughout the world. That's over the whole period of this project. 2,002 of those children have been examined since April of 2014, so that's in the last 9 months, I guess. We've seen 202 of those kids, and that included 44 children in Atlanta, 29 in L.A., 94 in Minneapolis, 29 in San Diego, 3 in Helsinki, and 3 in Rivne, Ukraine. So that's aim one and what we've accomplished this year in terms of seeing kids throughout the world, I guess. So we've developed a 15-minute DVD of a number of kids with fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm going to show you one of those here in just a second. This careful examination focuses, I think you realize, on minor malformations and structural development, which are characteristic of FAS, And the idea is for it to be used on a recurring basis in teaching and clinical practice as a diagnostic tool. So I think that what we're going to do is we had it embedded in this presentation, but it can't work that way. So we're going to show it on my laptop here.
Oh, no, it's actually, go ahead and play it.
You're right.
Yes.
Can everybody hear it?
Yep.
My name is Ken Jones. I'm in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California and Rady Children's Hospital. And I'm going to do a physical examination on a little boy today in order to help you to be able to recognize the fetal alcohol syndrome. This is a little boy who's now 2 years of age, and he has the fetal alcohol syndrome. When we initially became aware of the fetal alcohol syndrome, we thought that all children who had been exposed to alcohol, who were affected by alcohol, had this very specific pattern of malformation, which is known as the fetal alcohol syndrome. But we now know, after years of trying to study this, that prenatal exposure to alcohol causes a spectrum of problems. And at one end of that spectrum is the fetal alcohol syndrome. But at the other end of that spectrum are children who have what we call alcohol-related neurobehavioral defects, or ARND. And those are kids who have neurobehavior problems, but they do not have any of the physical problems. So today, I am going to focus specifically on this disorder, the fetal alcohol syndrome. It's a very specific pattern of malformation. These minor malformations are very subtle minor malformations, and they involve basically three different domains in the individual's physical examination. The first one is growth. Individuals with the fetal alcohol syndrome are growth delayed with respect either to height or to weight. And when I say they are delayed in terms of height or weight, I mean that they are equal to or less than the 10th percentile for height or weight, controlled for chronologic age, sex, and ethnic background. The next thing that children with the fetal alcohol syndrome have is microcephaly. And again, we're talking here about children whose head circumference is equal to or less than the 10th percentile. Again, for ethnic background, for sex, and for chronologic age. Then the next issue that these children have, or the next problem that these children have, is some very specific problems in facial development. They have short palpebral fissures, they have a smooth philtrum, and they have a very thin upper lip. And then finally, all children with the fetal alcohol syndrome have neurobehavior problems. So let's get started here. Alex is below the 10th percentile. In fact, he's below the 3rd percentile, really, for both his height and for his weight, and he was that way at birth as well. He has microcephaly as well, and his head circumference, again, is far below the 10th percentile and also far below the 3rd percentile in terms of its measurement. I'm just going to measure his head, and I want to impress upon you the fact that we try to give Alex the largest head circumference we possibly can, and it's 43.4 centimeters in his case, and that's way below the 3rd percentile. And we do it two times, really, two times to just be absolutely sure that we've got the right head circumference. And yes, I get 43.4 again. So he's got microcephaly. He's got growth deficiency with respect to height and weight. And in order to be diagnosed with a fetal alcohol syndrome, you have to have either height or weight below the 10th percentile. And then you also have to have microcephaly. Now, I'm going to measure his palpebral fissure. And the palpebral fissure is the distance, or it's the opening that the eye looks out of. So it's measured from the inner corner of the eye, or the inner canthus, to the outer corner of the eye, or the outer canthus. And when one measures this, one has to recognize that the inner canthus is anterior to the outer canthus, so that when you measure this, you can't put your ruler in this plane. You have to put it in this plane. And his left palpebral fissure measures 2 centimeters. And the thing that you have to recognize is that this is a very difficult measurement to make. So when you look at Alex's eye, you see that his outer canthus is very hard to see, whereas his inner canthus is quite easy to see. And so what you've got to do, to the extent that you can, is to get him to raise his eyelid. And when he raises his eyelid, he uncovers his outer canthus. And he has already done this for me once, okay. And I'm going to try to show you again. Look at that. So he's got short palpebral fissures, and I, generally speaking, just measure the left eye. And when I measure the left eye, I close my left eye so that I am looking at his left eye with my right eye. And if I were to measure his right eye, I would close my right eye so that I was looking at his right eye with my left eye. All right, so that's the palpebral fissure. The next thing that we look at that is critical as far as this diagnosis is the philtrum. And that's the area from the base of the columella, or the base of the nose, to the red part, or vermilion, of the upper lip. This is a lip philtrum guide that was developed by Susan Astley and Sterling Claren at the University of Washington. And what it does is it shows the philtrum of five different individuals. The philtrum is the area from the base of the nose, or the base of the columella, to the red part of the upper lip, or the red part of the vermilion. And what you see here is various different degrees of a smooth philtrum. So this philtrum is completely smooth, and the vertical ridges that are supposed to be there are completely gone. And this philtrum is a little bit less smooth than this one, and this is basically what the average philtrum looks like. And you can see here these vertical ridges here that run from the nose down to the vermilion border of the upper lip, and this is even a more prominent one, and this is a really prominent philtrum with these vertical ridges. Now, Alex has a philtrum that looks like this child's. It's completely smooth, as this child's philtrum is, but you need to recognize that we consider a philtrum that is a 5 or a 4 to be diagnostic of the fetal alcohol syndrome, and a 3 is a normal philtrum completely. So Alex has a philtrum that's a 5, and then his vermilion border is the same. And you see here that the vermilion border, and that's the red part of the upper lip, is smooth and it's thin, and he lacks those that Cupid's bow configuration of his upper lip. This is a little bit less so than this. And this is basically the average vermilion border. And Alex's vermilion border is a 5. So he has a smooth philtrum and a thin, smooth vermilion border of his upper lip. And that is very characteristic of the fetal alcohol syndrome. So Alex really has all three features in the face of the fetal alcohol syndrome. So he's got short palpebral fissures. He's got that very smooth philtrum, and he's got the thin, smooth vermilion border of his upper lip. In order to make a diagnosis of the fetal alcohol syndrome, you just have to have 2 out of the 3 features, but he has all 3. So as we think about this now, he's got growth deficiency with respect to both length and weight. He's got microcephaly, and he's got this smooth philtrum with a thin vermilion border of the upper lip. So what you have to realize here is that the primary effect of alcohol on the developing brain is, on the developing fetus, is the effect of alcohol on the developing brain. And this is true in his case, not only of the microcephaly, but it's also true of, as far as the palpebral fissures are concerned, and the philtrum and the vermilion border of the upper lip. It turns out that the palpebral fissure is a dependent structure. It depends for its development on the optic vesicle. The optic vesicle is an outpouching of the brain. So alcohol primarily affects the brain, and it primarily affects the frontal area of the brain. The result is that the optic vesicle is affected, and when the optic vesicle comes out to induce the palpebral fissure, it induces a palpebral fissure that is smaller than usual. Similarly, the philtrum and the vermilion border of the upper lip come from the developing brain as well. The diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome is not just made from that. This really requires a collaboration with a neurobehavioral psychologist, and that's not what I'm talking about today, but in order to have a true diagnosis of the fetal alcohol syndrome, we have him seen also by a neurobehavioral psychologist. You'll notice as you look at him there that he has a ptosis or a drooping of his eyelid, and it's more severe on the right side than it is on the left side, but it really is on both sides. And that occurs in about 12% of children who have the fetal alcohol syndrome, and it occurs in about 1% of the general population. Then if you look at his ears, he has completely normal ears. But kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome, again, in about 12% of cases, have a prominent median crus from here over to here is called the median crus. So that structure is called the median crus. And in about 10% of kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome, that goes all the way across there, and it doesn't as far as he's concerned. But as I say, it occurs in about 12% of kids who have the fetal alcohol syndrome and about 2% of people in the general population. Now, other features that are seen more frequently is a difficulty in pronating and supinating at the elbow. Now, I just want to say a word about looking for pronation, supination. You really have to do it with the child's elbow flexed. And the reason for that is if the child's arm is stretched out, when you rotate, you're really rotating the shoulder, not the elbow. So you have to flex the elbow. And when you do that, you see that his elbow flexes, his elbow pronates and supinates completely normally. Sometimes kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome have problems with their elbows. Sometimes they have contractures of the fingers. He does not have contractures of his fingers. See, he really extends his fingers quite nicely. All right, the next thing to be aware of that occurs more frequently in kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome is, in his case, the inability to completely extend at his knees. About 3% of children with a fetal alcohol syndrome have other joint contractures like this, and that's about 0.3% in the general population, and he has this inability to completely extend at his knees. On that picture, you can very nicely see the fact that he can't extend his at his knees. He really has his knees flexed at all time. And the other thing that kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome have more frequently is a heart murmur. And about 10% of children with a fetal alcohol syndrome have a heart murmur. That doesn't mean that he necessarily has a heart defect, but a heart murmur occurs more frequently in this disorder. So other features that we see in the fetal alcohol syndrome. Minor malformations, again, things that occur in less than 4% of the general population and have no cosmetic or functional significance. So kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome frequently have what we call a hockey stick crease. And you see there a hockey stick crease. The crease comes across and then goes up between the second and third fingers. And that crease is really acute enough so that if it was a hockey stick, you would be able to hit the puck with the hockey stick. If it's just a smooth curve, it really is not a hockey stick crease, and he just has it unilaterally on one side. Then other features that frequently occur more often in kids with a fetal alcohol syndrome is other aberrant palmar creases, and you can see here that his creases on his right hand doesn't have a hockey stick crease, but he has a very unusual crease pattern. You notice that his proximal palmar crease is really way down here as opposed to being across like that up there. So he has an aberrant palmar crease on that hand as well. Basically, what Alex has is the full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome. He really has most of the features that we see in this disorder. But again, I want to stress to you that prenatal exposure to alcohol, which we initially thought always caused the fetal alcohol syndrome, we now know it's not always the full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome. It's a spectrum of defects. And at the more mild end of the spectrum are children who do not have all the features, the structural features that Alex has, but clearly who do have neurobehavioral effects. There you go. Okay.
All right. All right. Any questions?
Yes, Michael, I'd like to comment. Ken, this is really a wonderful effort that you've put together, and it's going to be enduring in that it just so beautifully shows how to examine a child. There's so many things that I saw in there, you know, lining up the right eye, the correct eye, and you know, the challenges of making some of these measurements that people just presume are easily done, that will just clarify for people who are trying to do this exactly how to go about doing it. And I think it's just a major contribution. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thanks, Michael.
Any other comments?
Great job, Ken. Can you remind us again how you plan to distribute the video? Will it be online or by DVD?
Yeah. Well, it's a really good question, and it has a lot to do with the IRB that we have not been able to get mothers and fathers. To allow us to just allow these things to go viral. So we are going to have to distribute these in a pretty controlled kind of a way, and I'm not sure exactly how we're going to do this at this point. The CDC, we now have a grant with the CDC that is involved in education of physicians who are obvious pediatricians primarily, but also family practitioners, and we're looking into the possibility of being able actually to make a bunch of these DVDs and distribute them. But again, the IRB is going to be very I think it's going to be pretty difficult, and we're going to have to come up with some pretty specific issues as far as that's concerned.
Okay, anything else?
Yeah, this is Kathy Mitchell.
Yeah.
That was so beautiful. Thank you, and I love the way you acknowledged Alex and his family at the end. That was really a very important ending there. Yeah, keep us posted. I mean, we would love to, you know, work with you to, you know, get this out at least to physicians maybe, but do keep us posted on that. And I was wondering if you had any plans on having like a part two and three, doing, you know, maybe an assessment on somebody with partial FAS.
Yes.
And also, and the other piece is, I think it would really be helpful when you talk about referring the child to a behavioral psychologist to have, you know, a piece on that. Well, what do they do? That's always a big question that we're asked when, Why is that necessary, and what kinds of testing do they run? So that piece, I think, would be equally as important.
Yep, I think that's a good idea. Good idea.
Oh, and did you talk, I may have missed the beginning, did you talk about knowing maternal alcohol use in that?
You mean how to get at that, or what?
Yeah, that is necessary.
I'm not sure I did. Not sure I did. I don't think I did.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you. It was beautiful.
Thanks, Ken.
I don't know. Sarah Mattson sent me a link to a paper yesterday from Susan Astley. That was interesting because she says that measuring papaveral fissure size with anything other than the photographic tool is worthless. So I'll send you a copy of that paper.
I prefer not to receive it, thanks.
How old, Alex?
One of the few fetal alcohol papers where you are not cited.
Yeah, well, she has published a number of papers where I'm not cited.
But that's good. And can these be modified? I mean, are they editable from what they are now, or is this it?
No, they can be edited.
Okay, good. Just in case we have some things that, you know, like Kathy suggested for added about the alcohol exposure history, things like that. All righty.
Okay, so I've got another 5 minutes here, if that's...
I was going to ask you about the telemedicine.
Right. So I've got 5 or 6 slides here.
Right.
So our methodology for long-distance consultation is moving along, I think, really pretty nicely. Is Jeff on the phone, Wozniak, from Minneapolis?
He's conference today, so he's not.
Okay. Well, we're working closely with Jeff, and this is a two-phased approach. The first is, remote physicians have the capability to film the physical examination and securely transmit them via the internet to me for review and schedule a consultation. And we've already finished phase one of the process. We've Jeff has a pediatrician who works with him who does the physical examination, and then for phase one, I receive the physical exam on the video, and then I go over it, and then I make comments about it and send it back to her. And we've done that enough now so that we feel very comfortable that she, who I've also had a lot of time training when I've been in Minneapolis, that she's doing really great as far as doing a physical examination of children with who are thought to have FAS. So we're moving on to phase two, and that provides the opportunity for physicians in remote locations. I don't want to think of Minneapolis as remote, but physicians other than here in San Diego have the capability to perform the clinical examination and consultation with me during a live session at the remote site. So the idea here is that they will examine the kid with me looking through the telemedicine, through the video, at the same time they're examining it, and we can communicate with each other and discuss the examination as it moves forward. So phase one, we establish a collaboration, and as I said, that's completely finished. As far as phase two is concerned, we're proceeding at the University of Minnesota. The transportable exam station equipment will be sent to the University of Minnesota in March. Clinical and support staff will be trained on equipment utilizing the software and other documentation implemented in phase one, and Deanna, who's here with me now, will be with me, and she will do that training. Physicians will perform the clinical examination and consultation with me during a live session. The portable equipment can be used at various sites served by clinical staff working with Jeff, and pictures show what is included in the case, the laptop, camera, stethoscope, cables, et cetera. And here is the TES, or transportable exam station, we will take out to, and we've already got this, that we'll take out to Minneapolis next month. This is it's a very compact operation. You see it's smaller than that's it. On the left, you see that it's in a suitcase, except a small suitcase that goes in the overhead bin on the airplane. And on the right side, you see the top of the suitcase, or the lid of the suitcase, that has all the different equipment in it that is used by the person who's doing the physical examination. So things like a tongue depressor attachment, and you can even have an otoscope in there and an ophthalmoscope and so forth if you want to use them. And so we've also been thinking about where else we would like to go with this. And as I know Ed knows, and I think I've mentioned to most of you, the Ukrainian situation really fell through rather dramatically because of a variety of issues, not all of which is the situation in eastern Ukraine at this time, because where we are in western Ukraine, we don't feel much of that. But issues have made it impossible for us to continue this, doing what we're doing with the telemedicine in Rivne or Helminski, which are the two spots we go to. So I've talked to Jeff, and we are, and other people in Minneapolis, and they have a number of outreach sites in western Minnesota that are sites that have been set up by the university that are primarily Native American population. So I think that might be a place that we would like to go, and as another site. And Dan Savage has, when I talked to him the last time we were all together, he is very interested in having me talk to people at the University of New Mexico. And they have apparently a very sophisticated setup there in Albuquerque for this. And of course, they have outreach programs as well in Native American populations, as well as Mexican American populations, as well as their sites there in Albuquerque. So I think that they could very well be additional sites for this. In most circumstances, existing internet network services are sufficient to support both phases of long-distance consultation. Sites can use existing clinical systems and behavioral imaging software for consultations, and the portable equipment save facility costs required to support more permanent telemedicine physician carts. And the unit costs about $65,000 for everything that you've seen, including the hardware and software. So finally, the project provides handbook, training materials, technical support for site implementation. The methodology can be used again and again, allowing for site-specific service differences, and the portable equipment can be used at remote sites without internet connection and then uploaded to the center site after actual clinical exam is performed. And I think that's it.
So, Ken, are you doing this in association with the UC Telemedicine Center?
No.
Okay. And who's putting these kits together? Are you or?
You mean the kits in Minneapolis, for example?
Well, the kits that you.
Oh, the kits. I'm sorry. The kits. You mean the system?
Yeah.
Well, Deanna has been spearheading that. So she's sitting right here beside me right now. And she's had a lot of experience as far as this is concerned, and has done a great job as far as getting this all together. And she's been with me to Minneapolis once before, and will be going with me in March when we go out again.
But, I mean, is the object to make these available and then you provide them, or
Yes.
That they want them at remote sites in Albuquerque, outside of Albuquerque?
Yeah, well, that obviously would be a negotiable thing, but at this point, we have enough money in the grant so that we think we can provide some of these.
Okay, great.
Obviously, we can't do it everywhere in the United States, but we would, I think this is a, I was going to say relatively inexpensive. It's relatively expensive, but it's something that, it's portable. It's really something that I think has fantastic potential.
Hey, Ken, why does it cost so much? I mean, what's in it? Just briefly.
Yeah, Deanna's going to answer that, okay?
Well, as far as the diagnostic tools, along with just the unit itself, it's a specialized to be configured specifically to be HIPAA compliant. And basically that the software also is included in that price, which is a yearly fee for us to store videos, the exams, and consent forms, and photographs, all of that within that, and to link those particular items together that are also HIPAA compliant. So it's a combination of those two, the hardware and the software. So
it's the hardware. Is it a computer? Is it?
Yes, it actually has a laptop that's pretty standard issued, but it also is specifically configured to be secured by providing, you know, a live video feed, snapshots to protect the patient's privacy. And we're going through a Global Med is who we actually used. And it's also in collaboration with a couple other third-party companies that provide the software. So it's all kind of integrated within a couple companies. So, it's actually a specialized.
It's like proprietary stuff that's making it so expensive.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, for it to be able to read all the diagnostic tools, there's HD cameras that are specifically made to zoom in on features. Also, the stethoscope is actually a really interesting feature where you can, Dr. Jones can actually hear the heartbeat through the stethoscope from the other end of the telemedicine system. So he can actually perform that examination at his computer in his office and hear their heartbeats on the other end. So it's pretty high tech, and it's the great thing about this, it is a size of a suitcase. So if they were to actually, you know, go to some of these remote sites, if we didn't have a system there, it could actually easily be brought to that location.
Hi, this is Sarah. Ken, Warren, and I are going to sign off. We just wanted to say goodbye.
Thanks for joining. But it seems now that the issue is to get this information out so that people know about it. And, you know, I guess the IRB issue is one that needs to be resolved, and hopefully you'll be able to get apparent that this is a worthwhile endeavor and get some consent and assent and be able to do all that.
Right.
But and then to let people know about the DVD and remote possibility. And, you know, obviously you're going to have to figure out a charging system. You know, you're not just going to sit around waiting for people to dial in to ask for your help.
Right.
So. although I know you would do that, but UCSC will not let you do that. So, all right, Ken, it seems like things are going along, and it'll be interesting to see where this leads to now. Any other issues on Ken's presentation? All righty. Jennifer had some things about the data access.
Right, and can you help? I'm in Ed's office because my WebEx isn't working, and hopefully Jill can stop. So I'll just be really quick. But we have a tab on the website for data sharing, and
make it bigger.
On this page, we have the link to the CFAS data sharing policy. So I don't know, Jill, if you can link onto that.
Can you make that full screen, Jill? Does it work?
I have it full screen on my computer. Do you guys have the participants showing on the right?
It's your screen. That we need to make. At any rate, there is a link to the data sharing policy that went through the committee approval. In addition, there's a link to the request if a person wants to access data. So here's the policy. So that's gone through extensive review. And then there's the request to access data. So So this is a fillable form where the individual can provide all the relevant information. There's really kind of two pieces that I think we still need for this. And if you go back to the first page, one is the data use agreement, which we don't have created yet, and I'll have to go back to the committee to get that finalized. And then the other is that right now we just have the data dictionaries that were up on the site and have been up on the site for a long period of time that provide information about the specific variables. But we really need a more user-friendly way of communicating exactly what kind of data that we have. So although there is a link on this page to the research project so people can get an overview of what the projects are, I will be asking all the PIs to provide something that has a little more detail than their summary abstract that could probably help individuals who may have some interest to really have a good sense of what data might be available. So that's it.
Any comments? Suggestions, questions?
One comment is, I don't know how helpful this will be, but all funded NIH grants, their abstract end up on what we call Reporter, which is publicly accessible. So I don't know if there would be enough content there to help the external people understand what's going on and what might be available. But it'd be easy to link out to abstracts.
Well, we actually have those already on the site, and I think Jill just linked
it. Oh, I see it now.
Link on that page as well. It seems to me we need something in between the abstract and the detailed data dictionaries that just give a little bit more on the type of data that they might access. But I'm open to that suggestion.
Yeah, I don't think the data dictionaries basically give everything that we do, but you have to be familiar with the test to understand what's there. So I don't think they should be on this page. I think they should be further back when someone wants to look at them. But kind of like, well, the CVLT or whatever it is available, as mm-hmm. is the Vineland, and how many subjects are available. I don't want to get it so that we're doing other people's research projects for them, but I want them to know what is available that they can certainly have access to. And it's complicated because people who probably want these data probably want to intermingle the various projects, either the dysmorphology and behavior, dysmorphology and brain, genetics and brain or whatever. Find a way to kind of provide, we have information on this, but the sample sizes are too small to want to do about it. And we may, we still have time limits to which to publish our data, or we can make them available publicly. So the committee is going to have to do a little bit more work in trying to figure out the best way to share our data, which we certainly want to do, but at the same time protect our investigators and make it an easy-to-use site so we're not seen as trying to put in any obstructions between other outside investigators and sharing our data. So I think we need a little bit more work on this. All right, we've got like 5 minutes left, so any comments from the SAB or NIAAA?
Here is Helen Yazaret. I would like to comment regarding the data dictionaries, if I can.
Sure.
I noticed that some of the data dictionaries and input tools of the versions that are currently available are not presented on this list. And unfortunately, it's going to be that way almost all the time because we keep updating, we provide new versions. What my suggestion is that instead of providing the links to specific data dictionaries, it would be probably more feasible for people to see the explanation of the data, what kind of data we're gathering, but then provide them a general link for the downloads page where they would find the most recent version of the data dictionary and access input tool.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to say. I think you just said it better. And I agree completely. That's what I think the committee has to look into now. Any other comments? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think that's kind of what we need to have done, and I think we all agree with you on that.
Thank you very much, and please, you know, please let me know if I can be of any help to provide some information or, you know.
Thank you. You've been very good, Helen, in coming in and filling in here, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else from the SAB or NIAAA? All right, well, we'll let you all go back to council now. Next month, Jill, who's on for next month?
Next month we'll be taking off because most of you will be in Vancouver and we'll be meeting in person the middle of March, and it was to be Tatiana's developmental project.
Okay. What we need you to do is to get you those progress reports so we can put those together and get those out. Any ideas for who to invite to the meeting? If we can decide on developmental projects, I will be inviting those people. I don't know if we'll make it in time to do that, but we're going to try. And I guess that's about it. Any other comments, suggestions, questions? Well, for those of you in the northern part of the country, in the Northeast, good luck. And it's about 75 here today, so I sympathize with you. So have a great one, and I'll talk to you in Vancouver.
Thanks.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye.